That's calling. Mark is calling in now from the Utah Avalanche Forecast Center. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning, Leslie. Today, the main thing we're looking for is the effect of some of these northeasterly winds that drifted snow. The main heads up is that they do kind of funny things, blow in weird places, move snow in weird places. So soft slabs, wind-drifted snow will be the main thing to look out for. The danger will be moderate at upper elevations for this. And then with cool temperatures, maybe some clouds coming in this afternoon and a little bit of a breeze, we don't expect the snow to warm up too much, but the sun is pretty strong, so watch out for some wet, loose avalanches on the more south-facing slopes.
Okay, hey, thanks. KPCW News Time now. 8:10, good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. This is the KPCW Local News Hour. Stay tuned. In just a minute, we'll be checking in with Snyderville Basin Water Reclamation Director Mike Lures. Later on, Park City local and aspiring mountaineer Jen Drummond talking about her journey to become the first woman to complete all of the second 7 summits. And then finally, Park City Institute Executive Director Ari Ioannidis with details about the upcoming season and how the Institute is moving forward from here. Stay tuned. On the phone now with an update from the Snyderville Basin Water Reclamation District, I have Director Mike Lures. Good morning, Mike.
Good morning, Leslie.
So, let's see. We got the new Silver Creek treatment plant online last year. How is it working so far? Any problems?
Beautifully. The project came online about a year ago, and we went through the initial startup, and it worked great.
So you haven't had any problems, any tweaks that you needed to deal with?
We always tweak it to optimize the biological population that's used to treat the wastewater. But other than that, which is all completely expected, and those are the things we do on a regular basis. So, yeah, it's been working great. Very pleased with it.
So the highlights of the treatment plant is that it does more? And
that's
more?
Correct. This is a full advanced or tertiary treatment plant. We are now removing phosphorus and nitrogen to very low levels to protect the creek that we discharge into.
All right. And any savings due to some efficiencies from the blue plant?
Well, unfortunately, there's not savings because we're doing more. I mean, we do have high efficiency motors, lights, and those type of things. But the treatment is more involved, and there's more to it than there used to be. So the overall costs are higher, but when we rebuilt the facility, all energy-efficient equipment was installed.
Yeah. Are you back to doing tours of the treatment plant with
anybody? Yes, we are. Anyone that would like to take a tour of either facility, they can contact us, and we'll be happy to give them a tour. Masks are required, and we do social distancing. We do limit the number of folks, but we can usually take 8 to 10 with no problem.
Okay. And it was not cheap, and we're still paying it off. Were you able to pay cash, or did you just have to bond for it?
No, we bonded. We issued around $22 million worth of bonds. The good news is that the vast majority of the project, I'm talking like 92%, if I recall exactly right, is paid for by new growth. So our current customers only saw a very small increase as a result of this project.
All right. What's next then for the East Canyon Treatment Plant?
So as everyone knows, growth is occurring at a very rapid rate. So we are involved in expanding the East Canyon facility. This is a 6-year project. We initiated it in January of this year. It'll take 18 months to design the project and about 6 months to bid it out and do all those kind of things, and then about 3.5 years to build it. So with growth taking place now, we have to look way down the road to when we can get this project completed and have it online in order to accommodate the growth that's coming. So it's a 6-year project, and it's going to be by the time it's built, it'll be pushing $90 to $100 million.
Oh, my goodness. So, and will it be the same thing that you did kind of with Silver Creek, where you build a new plant and then tear down the old one, or are you going to remodel this?
No, not at all. This is strictly going to be adding on to what we have.
Okay. And again, how does that get paid for when you talk about $90 million?
This will be 98% will be paid for by new growth.
Okay. That's just with the impact fees and things like that?
That's correct. This will be funded with impact fees, and very, very little will be passed on to our existing customers.
All right. We have seen a lot of construction along 248 from the sewer district, as well as with the Park City Municipal Water Line. Is that project complete?
No, it is not. We have a large sewer line that collects the wastewater out of Park City and flows along or underneath 248 out to the Silver Creek treatment facility. That line was installed in 1985, and we are installing a new liner inside that pipe. It's a multi-year effort. It's about $12 million, and we have two sections left. The next section will be initiated on April the 26th, and this is a section from the interchange of 224 and 248 down to the high school pedestrian tunnel. And as a result, we will be working from 7 p.m. at night until 5 a.m. in the morning to avoid the traffic and try to limit or at least minimize our disruption. And that'll be completed by June the 4th. So first phase, April 26th to June the 4th, that work will be done at night. And then further down the road, starting at the high school down to Comstock, we have a section that will be started on June the 6th and completed on July the 15th. Much of that work is outside of the road, so that will occur during daylight hours.
Okay, and then we get to pave it all after that?
That's
once
correct.
Once the city's done as well.
Now, you say pave. We are installing a liner through the existing manholes, so there will actually be very little digging. This is a technology that was developed in Europe a number of years ago, and we've been using it extensively throughout our system, and it prevents us from having to dig up 248, which would be obviously very disruptive to the community. So we can install this liner down through the manholes and not have to actually excavate the street at all.
All right. Any other construction we should expect to see? I mean, eventually you're going to be making the rounds, I guess, to install these liners in all of the pipeline. Yeah?
We actually have over 100 locations that we will be installing a liner in 2021. And we've actually been doing that for multiple years now. Usually there's short sections that need to be replaced or a liner installed, and those are scattered throughout the community.
All right. Let's see. The district has also been involved in these COVID-19 wastewater studies. What's happened with these studies?
Okay, so we continue to take samples twice a week from each of our treatment facilities, and the samples are collected and sent to the university, and the genetic material associated with the SARS-CoV-2 virus is looked for. The idea is that this genetic material typically shows up in wastewater before the cases show up in the community. And we will continue to do that in cooperation with many other wastewater utilities throughout the state and through July.
So have we seen any significant findings from these studies?
Well, certainly when Summit County saw a spike in, say, around January, 1st of January, the genetic material, the number of copies of genetic material went up as well. So we generally see an increase in cases before the cases actually occur on the street. And currently right now, at East Canyon facility, we're seeing a little, a small amount of genetic material, so it's not down to zero yet. On the Silver Creek side, it's very, very low, and there's not many cases originating from the eastern one-third of the surface area.
So can you basically guess the amount of COVID cases like you can the number of visitors in town?
It's not quite that precise. It's an indicator, and it's just another arrow in the quiver for the state health department officials and local health department officials to get an idea of what's going on. Certainly, when we see an increase in genetic material, there's an increase in cases, but it's not a one-to-one like our flesh index is.
Yeah, and given that we've seen spring break, are you going to be having a look then just to see if those numbers should go up or the genetic material increases?
Certainly, you know, we collect the information, send to the health department, and if the cases or the genetic material, the amount of genetic material goes up, you know, we would anticipate seeing cases go up, but we're not seeing that yet.
Yeah. And then what have you seen kind of in your flush index? I mean, has the economic index kind of shown up in that flush index over the last year?
Oh, absolutely. You know, certainly when things were shut down a year ago, you know, the wastewater dropped significantly. It has crept back up, and interesting enough, the last 60 days has been very strong. This past weekend in particular, we saw flows back to normal, even a little above normal.
Wow. And that did create some problems for you, know, in terms of when you didn't see the amount of waste coming through?
Oh, it caused us a great deal of problems because we ramp up our biological population of microscopic organisms that's used to treat the wastewater. And we ramp that up right at the beginning of ski season every year because we have the influx of people coming to town. Last year, when that dropped off, we didn't have enough wastewater coming in to maintain our biological population. So we had to work very hard to reduce the biological population, but at the same time operate the treatment plant in such a way to meet our, you know, permit requirements.
So you almost have a recipe then for flows, I suppose. Huh?
We have very skilled operators, and there's a lot of biology and chemistry involved, and they work very hard at it. There's a lot of laboratory tests that are done, and they've absolutely done a fantastic job under trying times.
Finally, I just wanted to ask you, anything in the state legislature this year that has you concerned?
Not directly, no.
Okay. Anything else you'd like to mention?
Just real quick, Leslie, some folks may hear about this. We have initiated a microplastics research study in cooperation with Corollo Engineers and University of Arizona. People may not be aware, but wastewater treatment plants can be a major source of microplastics, and we're wanting to know what's coming in and what's getting through. We do know that because of our advanced systems that we have, the wastewater treatment systems that we have, that a large portion of these microplastics should be removed, but we want to verify that and get better understanding of what's going on.
So is that as a result of people, I mean, just doing laundry and the microfibers in laundry and the waste of that?
Right. Think of all the people that are wearing ski clothes this time of year. Most of those clothings are plastic or, you know, type of plastic based. And when you wash those, microfibers come off, and that's considered a microplastic. So we're sampling this month, and we'll be sampling again in July for non-ski season to quantify what's coming in.
Oh, interesting. Is there any other way that those microplastics would get into the wastewater stream?
Well, laundry is certainly the where the vast majority of it's coming from.
Okay. We'll have to make sure we check back and find out what we know in July then. Okay, Mike, appreciate it.
Hey, thank you for having me, Leslie.
That's Mike Lors. He is the district director for the Steinerville Basin Water Reclamation District. You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW. News time now, 8:23. Well, Park City local and former KPCW DJ Wyatt Pike has advanced on ABC's American Idol. KPCW's Sean Higgins has more.
The 19-year-old performed a duet of Alex Clare's Too Close with fellow contestant Cassandra Coleman on Monday's Duet Challenge episode.
You know I'm not one to break promises.
Pike and Coleman were praised for their performance and onstage chemistry. Judge Katy Perry commended Pike for making his singing partner feel safe after she experienced a bout of strong nerves earlier in the competition.
Wyatt, you made Cassandra feel really safe.
Right.
You weren't going to run without her, and that is what a duet does. You run together.
Fellow judge and country music star Luke Bryan told both Wyatt and Coleman they would be moving on to the next round, which airs on Sunday night at 8/7 Central on ABC. Sean Higgins, KPCW News.
Well, after a year of social distancing, making a reservation to ski and sack lunches at the resort, Vail Resorts is planning to bring even more people to the resorts, and they announced this morning that it is reducing all of its pass prices for next winter. Calling their program Epic for Everyone, Vail Resorts is reducing all of its pass products by 20% across the board. In addition, the company is launching its new version of Epic Day Pass. That starts at $67 for a one-day pass. The Epic Mountain Rewards program will continue to offer pass holders 20% off their dining, lodging, lessons, and rentals. This price reduction applies to the entire portfolio of the company's North American Pass lineup. Epic Pass products are now available to purchase at epicpass.com for next winter. In a prepared statement, Vail Resort CEO Rob Katz said that because of the growth and loyalty of their pass holders, navigating the most challenging season ever this winter, the company had a successful season at its 34 North American resorts. Quote, as we double down on our pass strategy by dramatically reducing our pass price, as Kat said, we're excited to make it easier for everyone to move into a pass, and we remain fully committed to ensuring continuous improvements in the guest experience. The Epic Local Pass is now available for $583 for next winter. That's down from $729 for the current season. The full Epic Pass is priced at $783. That's down from $979 for this winter. This reset will take these product prices back to the prices we saw during the 2015-2016 season. Today's announcement is part of Vail Resort's Epic for Everyone commitment to broaden engagement in the sport. Epic for Everyone began in 2019 with the introduction of the Epic Day Pass, designed to give new and occasional skiers the same value and flexibility that's offered with a traditional season pass. Well, as Vail Resorts reduces its pass product prices, Deer Valley, it will be increasing its passes next season, which was discussed in detail at Monday night's annual leadership lecture. KPCW's Carolyn Murray has highlights.
Alterra Mountain Resort acquired Deer Valley in the summer of 2017 and with it brought a new marketing model. They joined other large mountain resorts by offering expanded season pass sales. With 15 mountain operations and about 30,000 employees, Alterra CEO Rusty Gregory said it's tricky to keep each resort's unique cultural qualities under the umbrella of the large parent corporation.
Alterra Mountain Company is very young and it has a very young culture. Our vision is to be one company of many unique brands building a global mountain community. So that's like talking out of two sides of your mouth, right? And so we're trying to get the best of both worlds. We believe that the platform that is Alterra and that is the Icon Pass, the way we kind of bind the companies together is a way to do really help our individual resorts and the brands that they represent and have been for years to actually become more of themselves, to not be a piece of Alterra except for in the back of the house.
Park City Leadership Executive Director Miles Rademan said the local audience listening wanted to understand why Deer Valley raised season pass prices for senior citizens. Deer Valley President and CEO Jeremy Levitt responded and said their research showed that many resorts had done away with senior season passes. He noted that the decision to discount senior passes by 25% off an adult pass is in line with other resorts.
85% of the questions that came in dealt with the whole senior pass issue. So why don't we, that's the elephant in the room. Really, why don't we just talk about that and you can tell us what your thoughts are.
Sure. You know, we did not make this decision lightly and a lot of discussion and research went into the change. The reality is that the standard industry rate for senior pass holders is 20 to 25% off whatever the adult season pass rate is. And I know that's tough to hear, but the new price fairly reflects the value of a seven-day pass unrestricted access.
Rademan pressed Levitt and explained the concerns he has heard from the community. Levitt said the resort still offers a locals pass.
Some of the questions that we got were, are you turning your back on your long-term supporters in a sense, you know, who have supported you through thick and thin over 25 or 30 years? Is there anything that you're not doing for the locals that you should be doing for them?
So we still have a locals pass. That's a five-pack product that comes at a discount to the lift ticket. 60% of our season pass holders don't even have Utah addresses attached to them. So look, we love our locals. We support our locals. We're just a business. And when you run a business that's seasonal, cyclical, capital intensive, labor intensive, you have 90 days to make 150% of your annual profit. Certain things have to be done.
Altera's Rusty Gregory said resorts across the organization adjust pass prices regularly.
If it's not the right price, the market will tell us. You know, the people will be incensed enough, not that this is our intention, you know, that they won't buy tickets and we don't want to lose the patronage. So pricing is dynamic. We set prices and when they're wrong, we'll change them. And if they're right, we'll keep to them. And it's a way of allocating scarce resources.
Gregory said resort managers have a tough balancing act between guest satisfaction, capital investments, employees, and local communities.
Then the question is, what do we do about it? And the answer is, I don't think we know yet. Otherwise, we would have done it. But as we go into next year for pricing and understand how pricing that we're putting in place next year affects people, it'll evolve over time and we'll continue to try to get it right as close as we can.
Carolyn Murray, KPCW News.
8:31 now, good morning. Well, aspiring mountaineer and Park City local Jen Drummond is on a journey to become the first woman to complete all of the second seven summits. Those are the second highest mountains of each of the seven continents. Jen joins me now on the phone to tell us more. Good morning, Jen.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing well. So start by just telling us a little bit about yourself, who you are, what you do, and how you came up with this idea to do the second seven summits.
Yeah. So I have seven children. Last year, one of them came home from school complaining that he didn't like doing his math homework. And we talked about how our family does hard things. And he knew I liked mountaineering. He's like, well, if you do hard things, then why haven't you climbed Mount Everest? And I'm like, let's look into that. So we looked into it. The kids brought some books home. And I said, all right, I'll climb Mount Everest, which I'm doing. I'm leaving April 18. And so in a couple weeks. But while hiring a coach to look at Mount Everest, he was talking to me and, you know, we had COVID, so he had all this training and everything. And he's like, why don't you do the 7 second summits? You have the personality for it. Your kids can each pick a mountain peak and see what happens. And that's kind of where it came from.
Okay. So you have already started. You've got a couple of them under your belt.
Yes, I have. I started. So I have Ojos del Salado, which is done in Chile. And then I just came back from Mount Kenya in Kenya. I leave for Everest next month, which is a training mountain for me to prepare me for K2, which is the second summit on that continent.
So while these second summits aren't as high as the seven summits, I think K2 is an example. Some of them are more difficult to climb.
Yeah, no, they are more difficult to climb. So, for example, K2, there's been more people in space than the top of that mountain. I just got back from Mount Kenya. So Kilimanjaro would be your first summit on Africa's continent. And that's pretty much a hike. Mount Kenya was a 20-pitch rock climb and rappel. So, and then some of them are harder just because logistically you don't have commercial outfitters running trips to those locations. So you're doing a lot more of it yourself.
All right. So if you would be the first woman to do this, I mean, how many men have actually done the second seven summits?
It's been, per the Guinness Book of World Records, it's been completed by 2 males so far.
So you're telling me how dangerous it is. you have 7 kids. How do you leave knowing that you may not come back?
You know, we have a promise to each other that that I will come back before I'll summit. So if the conditions are not conducive to make for a safe summit, then I'll just return home and we'll try it again. And I think that lesson to the kids is just as important as, you know, we go for goals, but that doesn't mean we force them.
All right. I mean, so did you grow up as a rock climber?
No, actually, I grew up in Michigan. I moved to Park City, Utah in 2015. And then was introduced to mountaineering from a friend out here and fell in love, and there we go.
Yeah. So what else do you have left to climb?
I have K2 this summer, which is scheduled. And then there's Dick Tau in Russia, waiting for those borders to open. There's Mount Logan in Canada, which is a June climbing season. So hopefully June of 2022. And then there's Mount Tyree, which is in Antarctica. The goal is to try to climb that in January of 2022. And then the last one is called Sumantri, which is in New Guinea. And that currently is not climbable just because of political unrest. So when that's safe to climb again, that's next to Carstens Pyramid, which is a first summit. I'll make that happen. We just have to make sure it's safe first.
Yeah. And how are you dealing with all of, just given the restrictions of COVID?
You know, it makes it a little bit more challenging, but the mountains are not as busy. And when you go into the communities, you just get to connect with the people so much more. And they're so grateful that you're there. And they're like, yay, tourism is coming back. This is a sign that, you know, the world's coming back together to somewhat normal. So it's been, I guess, both sides of the story.
So what's been the most difficult so far?
Mount Kenya was a little difficult just because you're at the equator. So you have 12 hours of light to work with. It's a technical climb. So you want to get as much done as you can without having to deal with the dark. And that culture is still very patriarchal. So being a female climbing over there was, had its challenges a little bit.
Yeah. And certainly this is not a cheap sport. How are you financing this?
It's not a cheap sport. I am lucky that I owned a financial service company and have saved money for a long time. It sounds like there's some companies that are willing to support financially as well, which is inspiring. So a combination of personal funds and other funds.
Okay. So, I mean, when you take off for Mount Everest, I mean, you're leaving April 18th. I mean, that's, you're gone probably a good month, right?
Yeah, I'm gone almost 4 weeks. Lucky for me, we have a live-in nanny who I used to nanny her children. So she's basically family. And then my mom comes out and stays with the kids and spoils them rotten. And with technology these days, you're actually able to FaceTime even from base camp. So I have kids up at Parley's Park in Park City, and we're doing this campaign this spring called What's Your Everest, and helping the kids like set goals and make little adjustments as they're getting closer to their goals. And when I'm at base camp, I'm gonna be able to call into the school and have the classrooms ask different questions of what's going on.
All right. So do you plan to write a book about all of this once you're finished? Or,
you know, I think everything's open at the time right now. My goal is to do this whole experiment with mountain climbing. And by doing that, hopefully inspiring others to get outside, think about what their goals are, and start putting things together for themselves while they do their job or their kids or other roles that we all have.
Yeah. So your kids range in age from what to what?
So my youngest are 8 and my oldest is 14.
Wow. Okay.
So they're tightly packed in there.
Yeah. And how are people going to be able to follow along your journey?
That'd be wonderful. So we have a website set up called boldbravebeautiful.com. On there, you can, there's like Garmin tracking device, so you can track where I am on the mountain. I try to send dispatch notes every day. And then also on Instagram, I have the handle Bold Brave Beautiful Life.
Okay. All right. Well, gosh, anything else you'd like to tell us?
Yeah, no, I just appreciate being able to share the story, and hopefully people can follow along and be inspired.
All right. Well, best of luck to you.
Thank you. Take care.
That's Jen Drummond, again, Park City local and aspiring mountaineer, again, hoping to complete all of the second 7 summits. Well, the Summit County Council is planning for the future on a couple of different fronts in their regular meeting today. The council may come to a decision on the proposed neighborhood mixed-use zone. Meanwhile, they're also talking about bike racks. The council will be meeting electronically shortly before 4 o'clock on the agenda today. They'll get a presentation on a bike rack design contest that is being held in conjunction with the University of Utah. Summit County Manager Tom Fisher told us it's part of their effort to improve transportation infrastructure.
As we go into enhancing some of our transit stops in the future, we have some funding along with Park City to do some of that work, or we've allocated some federal funds to do that. We also want to make sure that we're doing something unique to enhance the availability of places to park and lock and your bike, as well as be able to ride the transit system. So we have an opportunity with some architectural students down at the U to look at how we can do that uniquely and in concert with what fits our community. So we're taking advantage of that.
And certainly some of the concerns by bikers are that there aren't enough of them, and they certainly emphasize cuteness over utility.
And utility is one of those things. I mean, you know, the basic big U-pipe that is used normally to do bike racks are good for locking up bikes, but they're not the most attractive form of use for that. But, you know, so we'll be judging utility along with some of the uniqueness of the designs as well to see if they provide something better.
I guess I'm kind of thinking of those bike cutouts too, where you get two bikes per rack. I mean, it's a lot of metal for two bikes.
Yes.
Yeah.
Exactly. I think something better can be done.
Certainly another challenge for bike racks is keeping them out of the hot summer sun.
Well, it's a challenge, isn't it? I mean, when you're talking about where most of our transit stops are, and this is what we're talking about is bike racks around our transit system. They're usually in road right-of-ways where there's not necessarily, especially along our collectors, where there's not a lot of trees or other types of shade structures. So maybe that design also looks at how it can work with a shelter in order to provide some of that shade. There's a lot of different things that could be incorporated into that utility.
Fisher added that they will be awarding a cash prize for the best bike rack design. On another topic, the county council convenes at about 5 o'clock this afternoon to further discuss and perhaps make a decision on the neighborhood mixed-use zone. Their decision is going hand-in-hand with their consideration of a proposed master plan development process. A public hearing and possible decision there is set for about 6 o'clock. Fisher said that they may take a vote on the two items together. The council is looking to this MPD concept to answer some questions. For example, Councilmember Chris Robinson recently asked just what is the appropriate setback from a mixed-use development.
That is one of the outstanding questions, and I believe that Roger Armstrong also had some issues with those setbacks as it relates to those types of developments in this type of zone. So I believe that staff will be answering those questions.
That's Summit County Manager Tom Fisher. KPCW News Time now, 8:43. The Snyderville Basin Planning Commission last night unanimously voted to recommend a set of Snyderville code amendments on accessory buildings. KPCW's Rick Bruff has more on that.
The code amendments are being proposed since Basin residents in recent years have expressed concerns about the impacts of accessory buildings, the number that are allowed on properties, and the concern they may morph into commercial uses. About 2 weeks ago, the Summit County Council approved a six-month moratorium on new accessory buildings. The proposed amendments, said the county staff, aim to ensure that accessory buildings are subordinate to the principal building on a lot. They set size limits and other restrictions in two categories for minor accessory buildings and major buildings. A public hearing on the proposed amendments drew comments from only two citizens. However, Old Ranch Road resident Debbie Scoggin had several concerns. She presented photos of two properties in her neighborhood that she said show accessory buildings are getting out of control.
Rural residential zoning says one house per 5 acres or 10 acres. We rely on that zoning when purchasing our homes and spending money to enhance and maintain them well into the future. However, by allowing the proliferation of these outbuildings, the zoning doesn't look like it is intended to look. All you see is a sea of rooftops. From the community's point of view, one residential house and three outbuildings is still four rooftops. This flies in the face of our zoning mandates, which were put in place to protect our sense of place and open space.
Scoggin said that multiple outbuildings on a property should be clustered and tucked in as close as possible to the primary building there. She added, lights in accessory buildings intrude on the night sky, and the buildings exacerbate the problem of stormwater runoff. She said there should be landscaping to shield the buildings. She added that the proposed amendments should go further to restrict accessory structures.
That's what I think they are. They're an end run around the zoning laws. The square footage amendments being offered for minor accessory buildings are way too generous, onerous to the community's sense of open space and zoning, and not necessary. I urge you to greatly scale down the footage on all the minor and major accessory buildings, or outlaw these buildings altogether. I got rid of stuff and I didn't put a storage thing out. I just scaled down. Most of these people have 3-car garages. When is enough enough?
A resident of Silver Creek also spoke, saying her neighborhood has seen buildings that are not proportional to lot size, and she said the county needs to implement a human scale in the structures. The amendments are now going on to county council, which has scheduled a public hearing next week on March 31st. For KPCW, I'm Rick Bruff.
Well, it's been more than a year since there's been an in-person audience at the Park City Eccles Center for the Performing Arts. In the studio, with a look ahead at what might happen next, I have the executive director of the Park City Institute, Ari Ioannidis. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
So what have you been doing this last year?
It's been actually a really great year. You know, it's funny. I was just looking over what we did in the past year, and you know, just to review, my first day as executive director was March 1st. You know, we've had one show, live show since then. It was Eli Saslow. And then, you know, we canceled Saints and Sinners, canceled our entire summer series, canceled the winter series. And I was just so excited about the summer series. But one of the things that we wanted to do was to partner better with local artists. So, you know, COVID allowed us to take that Locals Live series and put it online. And I was actually looking at it last week. We were doing some work on the website. It's really good stuff. I mean, the National Parks just played Vivint Smart Home Arena. You know, that was our last act. And they did a great job. So, I would encourage listeners to, you know, go to the website, parkcityinstitute.org, and go to Locals Live. And you can see the performances there. They're all, you know, on YouTube and on our YouTube channel. So I think you'll be impressed.
So looking ahead, I mean, will we have a season?
Well, we've planned a season, just like we had before. These artists, you can't just call them 2 weeks before a show. So we have to plan it out in advance. We had planned to host Complexions Dance. It was very aspirational and kind of, you know, wishing that we would be open. But we've since postponed that back into July. My feeling is, and what we're hearing from the school district, because obviously the health and safety of the students and staff are most important, that when we enter the low transmission level in Summit County, and we've just switched it over to moderate, that we will once again be able to host live shows. So I'm optimistic. I think by late June, early July, you know, we'll be able to do that.
Yeah, because you have the lease with the school district, they have basically the final say of when you can get back in there?
I wouldn't say it's a lease. You know, we helped raise almost a third of the funds to build that facility, and it was the desire of the community to have a real community center, a place where you could hold a Broadway play or bring in a national act, and we've, you know, taking over the mantle of that. I mean, Terry did a great job for so many years bringing in wonderful national acts, and we're going to continue that. But it is a partnership. They do take priority. The summer months are kind of easy for us because there's no school. And we have planned out that season. So hopefully we'll be able to do it.
Yeah. So, I mean, we've got like the Jim Sanning Auditorium opening on a reduced level next month. So you don't feel like you could do the same? Do it at reduced numbers?
You know, we really need to defer to what the school districts say. You know, and they're doing a great job. Their policy is no outside anything until we reach that low transmission level. I honestly think that's a good decision. I mean, to err on the side. You know, would I like to open up? Do we have space? Could we put 300 people in the Eccles because it holds 1,200? Yeah, probably. But, you know, also, I don't think I want to push it. And I don't think our patrons would appreciate us being kind of cutting edge when so much is at stake. So, yeah, let's wait. Let's get to the low transmission level and do it then.
So how hard is it, though, to book acts? I mean, I guess I have heard from someone that, you know, acts are asking for 50% of their contract up front, no refunds if it's canceled due to COVID.
Well, that's typically what's happening. So one of the first things we did early on was, and that's usually what people want, but there, most acts are anxious to get out there. Some acts are afraid to. So the clause in our contract goes something like this: 30 days prior to the event, we'll have a conversation. If state, local, and federal authorities allow us to have the event, at that point you get your deposit. Otherwise, we're going to cancel the show. And likewise, we don't open up ticketing until that point as well. So this makes it simpler for us. It's easier for the artists. And there's another clause down there that says, hey, look, if we can't hold it even after the 30 days, you know, all the money won't disappear. We're a nonprofit. We don't have millions in the bank.
Yeah. You have kept, I mean, in addition to yourself, you have kept a couple of staff members on board?
Yes, there's two of us on staff, me and Jenny, and that's it right now.
Okay, so yeah. You'd have to bring back all your technical crew.
Yes,
then. Yes.
Everyone's on furlough. We've continued to pay health insurance for our staff members who had health insurance before. I think that's important to do. It's just the right thing to do. And we've been able to reduce as many costs as we possibly can, but we're still paying rent. We're still paying utilities and, you know, all the things that we normally do.
Yeah, so where's that money coming from?
I want to really thank our patrons. I mean, it was just amazing. We put out a call last August, as did the other performing arts organizations, and our people really stepped up. So I would say, number one, our patrons. Number two was federal and local aid, so mostly through the CARES Act. We received a great deal of funding from them. And Utah Arts and Museums gave us a really nice grant to help plan out this season. So I just really want to reach out to all the organizations who helped sustain us, because we were in the hole in March. So we had to not only sustain ourselves, but dig out of a hole.
Yeah. Now, this was certainly before your time, and it was when Deer Valley, the outdoor venue, went away, and it was like, now where do we go? At that time, I remember hearing that Bill Rock was expressing interest in saying, you know what, we've got a lot of construction going on at the base of canyons. We can't do something, but we'd like to. So has that materialized at all?
Wow. How did you hear that? That's a great question. I can't say yet. I will say that I am optimistic that in 2022, we will be back in an outdoor venue, and that it'll be similar to what the experience you had at Deer Valley. So whether it's at Deer Valley or some other place, we will have a permanent home and plan to put on about 10 shows of that same size and scale that you saw before.
Okay. So as you say, you're planning a season. The first one is scheduled?
Well, yeah. You know, we had it keeps changing. But right now, the hard, big first absolute scheduled show will be Jocelyn and Chris Arndt. I mean, these are for Saturday, July 17th. There are two shows we think will happen before that. But this is rapidly changing, and I'll give you one example. Well, first, let's talk about Jocelyn and Chris. If you're a fan of old, real rock and roll, and these guys are, I call them kids because I'm in my 60s, but this is a brother-sister act, not to be confused with like the Carpenters or anything. So if Janis Joplin and Jimi Hendrix were on stage, this is sort of like what you would hear. Go check them out. They're very, very good. We're super excited to bring them to the Eccles, and they're excited to be here. So that'll be the first absolutely hard scheduled. Then we have Big Bad Voodoo Daddy. They've been here before, July 30th. And Stephanie Land, who we had to cancel a couple of times, one for health reasons and one for COVID, is Saturday, August 14th. We're thrilled to continue the speaker series. And then I'm not allowed to have favorites, so I won't say this is my favorite, but Marty Stewart. So if you've watched Ken Burns' country music show or the recent special that was done by the Grand Ole Opry on TV, Marty Stewart's kind of like the holder of all this knowledge. Not only that, he's a great mandolinist. He's played with virtually everybody and super good on guitar. They didn't want to bring a full band, and we suggested, hey, why don't you bring a string band, kind of like Grand Ole Opry style. And so you'll hear a great acoustic show from Marty Stewart on August 21st. So we're thrilled. Those are the hard and fast shows. We had Gretchen Wilson scheduled for Pioneer Weekend. Super excited about that. And then she called, and this, you asked about cancellations, and so we have to be flexible too. She tours with her whole family. So like her, one of her family members is a tour manager, and everybody comes with her, and they're still not ready to tour and to do a full tour. So it's not, they just can't pick up and come to Park City and then go home. They really need to put a whole tour together. So they've asked that we allow them to cancel that show. We propose that they also do an acoustic show. She did something called the Church Sessions, where they did acoustic show. It's really interesting. So we're waiting to hear back, but I doubt she'll be coming. So we'll look for a replacement for that.
Okay. So people just really need to check back. I mean, because we wouldn't know if tickets were going on sale until 30 days before they were going
yes.
on sale.
So if you go to the website, once again, parkcityinstitute.org, you can actually sign up to be notified when the tickets go on sale. And we will let you know when that happens. Everyone on our mailing list will automatically, believe me, hear that we're selling tickets. And most likely I'll ask to come back and speak again.
Okay. All right. Anything else you wanted to mention?
No, that's about it. I really want to thank everyone once again for stepping up and donating. I know that you're used to donating and getting something in return, but we've had people step up when we don't have tickets or shows or something. I will say two other things. We look out for Locals Live. That'll happen again this year. And just a little teaser. We have a lot of swag and stuff sitting around. There will be a yard sale.
Okay. Yeah, I'm just looking at the website now. And just this picture just so almost sad. I mean, it's beautiful grand piano with just empty audience.
I know. Yeah. I actually took that picture.
Oh,
we didn't
nice
have
picture.
The money to have some.
Okay. Hey, Ari, thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Leslie.
It's Ari Ioannidis again, Executive Director of the Park City Institute. You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW. News time now, 8:58. Summit County has relied on two or three sources of funding to help businesses survive this past year of the pandemic. The council getting a review of those monies during their regular meeting today. Summit County Manager Tom Fisher said they received about $1 million from the Federal CARES Act and have dispensed grants for all of that. The funding went to businesses and nonprofits. Fisher said that they had to meet certain criteria for that funding, including hiring low and moderate income employees.
Of course, there was a point system involved with it, and we were attempting to be as liberal as we possibly could in order to make as many nonprofits and small businesses eligible, because a lot of those places were kind of left behind by some of the larger PPP programs that were available from the federal government.
He added that they also have received CDBG grants of about $450,000. The county's economic development director, Jeff Jones, also reports that they got about $100,000 in rural county grants, but have only dispensed about half of that.
It was going towards anything that would help that business prepare for or react to the current conditions and prepare to launch once conditions improved. And one of the reasons that we're seeing, or that Jeff Jones has cited for some of that money not being granted out so far, is that, you know, people are anticipating this larger amount of money coming from the federal government, and you know, perhaps some of these smaller grants aren't as attractive. But, you know, as that starts to shake out over the next few months, I think we're going to see some more interest in the remainder of this money as well.
And he said that some of Summit County's economic sectors have returned to the same activity levels they saw a year ago.
Construction has done very well. Retail has done relatively well, although there was a spike in the December, January timeframe, and then we've lost a little bit since then. Where we're seeing the big drop, and this is consistent throughout the entire incident, has been in lodging and restaurant and the arts and culture industry especially.
That's Summit County Manager Tom Fisher. This is KPCW Park City.